Jennifer Streaks now, senior personal finance reporter and spokesperson for the personal finance vertical at Business Insider. Businessinsider.com is the website. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
I'm reading what you wrote, four financial moves to make before the end of the year. Let's do the headlines. What are the things that we should be doing before the year's out?
Well, the first one is going to be to fully contribute to your 401k. So the maximum, you know, contribution is $22,500. If you're 50 or older, you've got that little bit of wiggle room because you want to maybe catch up. So it's $30,000. You know, you need to make those contributions by December 31st. So you can go ahead and get that in there. And also, if you can, take this time to plan for your IRA contribution, if that's applicable. You have until April 15th, 2024 to contribute to your IRA account for 2023, but start planning to make that happen now if that's what you want to do.
You also said, I'm reading your list. Check in with your health care. That's number two on your list. What do you even mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, open enrollment, maybe starting with your company, if you have health insurance through your employer right now, check in and see if you have all of the coverage that you need. Do you anticipate something that might come up next year? Are you planning on maybe getting pregnant? Is there some sort of treatment that you might need? Make sure that you have the adequate coverage right now so that there aren't any surprises in the year ahead.
You know, what's frustrating to me is if you have a health savings account or a flex plan and you have to use those dollars or receive services for their use in the calendar year. I have had to eat money before, and that's so frustrating, you know.
It is.
Number three on your list is check in with your credit. What's that all about?
Yeah, definitely. Take this time to really sit down and look at all three of your credit reports, see what's on there. Are you happy with your credit score right now or how you're handling your credit? You might need to work on your credit, make that a goal for next year. Take time to pull all three, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. You are entitled to a free credit report every year from each of the three credit bureaus, and you can access that by going to annualcreditreport.com. So it's good to just have a handle on your credit and know where you stand.
You have an estimate of what the number should be. It used to be 700. Is it still 700, the line?
It is 700. I mean, in some cases, you have 679 to 680. That's going to get you approved. But if you want the best interest rate, it's going to be a 700.
Prepare for tax season. What's that?
Yeah, take time now to think about tax season. Don't wait until the April 15th deadline is approaching. Start gathering your paperwork, decide whether or not you're going to do the standardized deduction or whether or not you can itemize. And if you decide to itemize your deductions, especially if you want to take advantage of charitable donations to bring down your taxable income, then you've got to make those donations before the end of this year so that it can have an impact on your filing next year. So just go ahead and start thinking about that now. Don't wait until the last minute.
You wrote about phantom costs for home ownership. What's a phantom cost in a home?
Phantom costs are hidden costs that you don't even think about when you're signing up for your mortgage. Most people, when they're thinking about buying a home, they're only considering what the mortgage payment is going to be. But there's so much more to owning a home. There's landscaping costs. There's mortgage interest. There's homeowner's insurance. There is just things that happen. Like, for instance, when I owned a home, I had to replace the washer dryer like 90 days after I moved in. So when you're thinking about buying a home, you have to think about phantom costs. It's not just the mortgage payment. It's also everything else that goes into that that can make the home so much more expensive than what you're anticipating.
The author of a book called I Will Teach You How to Be Rich, Ramit Sethi, said that those costs can be 50% of your home cost. That is, take the mortgage, and then another half could be the annual cost for owning a home. That's a good number to remember. Jennifer Streaks is a senior personal finance reporter at businessinsider.com. Okay, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your time today. The Wintrust Business Lunch, Bree Fowler joins us, the senior writer at CNET. Bree, let's talk a little bit briefly about the new Pixel phones, and then I want to ask you about some other stories in the news. Tell me a little bit about this one.
Sure. Google has unveiled their newest Pixels, the Pixel 8 and the Pixel 8 Pro. And, you know, just like in past years, we're looking at better cameras, new tricks and tweaks to those, but also, you know, an increasing use of artificial intelligence.
So it's the Pixel phone. How long has Google been making a smartphone?
Well, I want to say it's probably, they're on the 8 and the 8 Pro now. It's been about 8 years, you know, on or off. They've had one about every year.
I don't suppose there's an easy answer to this. Is it better than the iPhone? I mean, which should I get, the Pixel or the iPhone?
Well, I haven't really had my hands on these yet. They just had their press preview. But, you know, it's more for fans of Android that want an alternative to Samsung. Google has been the main challenger to Samsung. Samsung dominates the Android market. Google has had lower priced phones and, you know, kind of trying to appeal to someone who wants something a little different.
And there are more Android phones on the market than there are iPhones, right?
Globally, especially. And once you get outside of the U.S., the Apple presence drops off, especially in countries where, you know, people aren't going to be spending about $1,000 on a phone.
The camera's called the Pixel. Does it have an awesome, the phone is called the Pixel. Does it have an awesome camera?
You know, it's one of those things where we're going to have to test it and see exactly what you're getting for your money. Really, all of the high-end phones these days, they have cameras that, you know, years ago we couldn't have even fathomed that a phone could do something like what they do.
Launches October 12th, so it'll be in the stores in a week, is that right?
Yeah, and the Pixel 8 starts at $700, and the Pro starts at about $1,000. And those prices are about $100 more than what you would have paid last year for the 7.
Talk about the trial of Sam Bankman-Fried, the FTX guy who is in jail right now, right? They actually removed him from his parents' home because he was violating the terms of his release with monitoring. And so he's in jail, and now he's on trial. What's happening there?
Well, I mean, I feel like this has been going on forever, but the trial itself has finally kicked off. Federal prosecutors say that, you know, he lied to the world, quote unquote, that, you know, this resulted in one of the biggest financial frauds of this generation. You know, conversely, his lawyers say that their client was, you know, a well-intentioned entrepreneur who acted in good faith and really didn't intend to defraud anyone. So, you know, the trial is going to hopefully sort all that out.
The loss of money came from a hedge fund that was being operated by his associates. And when the hedge fund was making bad bets and losing money, they were taking the FTX money, putting it in there without telling everybody. It became kind of a pyramid scheme. And then the whole thing blew up.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unclear how this money was being used. I mean, this was supposed to be an exchange and crypto and things like that. But, you know, federal prosecutors say that it was used for venture capital, political donations, luxury real estate purchases, things like that. You know, of course, Bankman-Fried has pled not guilty. It's 7 counts of money laundering. And if he is convicted on all these counts, he could basically get what amounts to life in prison.
Is that what they do? I mean, it's massive, but it's a white collar crime. Is that kind of penalty handed down to somebody? He's 31 years old.
What it is it's a stacking of years. 7 counts, you know, they're not life sentences in themselves. But, you know, when you add all that up, it's going to last a bit longer than he will probably.
Just speaking of trials real quick, have you been following then the FTC suit against Amazon? They're saying that Amazon is engaged in antitrust anti-competitive practices. What's the news on that front?
I haven't actually been following this very closely, but, you know, the FTC, whose job is to, you know, ideally protect consumers, is saying that, you know, Amazon, just by virtue of being so big, gives consumers, you know, not options, that they tried to snuff out the competition and left people with, you know, not as many places as they would have to shop. And when you have less competition, you have higher prices.
It's interesting because people love Amazon and they love the next day delivery and all that it offers and that big buy now button. My understanding is, though, that if somebody else who's using Amazon advertises their product for even a penny less on a different site, Amazon has crawlers that go through the internet. They find that, and if they discover that you are advertising something for a better price on a different site than theirs, you don't get delisted, but it's hard to find now your stuff on their site. They control the price. Your sales go to zero if Amazon doesn't put a big buy now button on your page. Mm-hmm. And so people have to conform to the pricing structure that Amazon says. You can't advertise it or sell it for less on a different site. I guess technically that hurts consumers, but I think people kind of like Amazon for how well it runs.
I think a lot of people have a love hate with Amazon. Yeah. But they hate being dependent on it. You know, you hear all these stories about how workers are treated, but at the same time, people they miss having stores that they can go to. But if people don't shop locally, those stores can't survive. So, it's this kind of vicious cycle. We're all kind of, hooked on Amazon, whether we want to be or not.
I think that's a good way to put it. That's Bree Fowler, senior writer at CNET. Let's talk again, Bree. It's always a pleasure to visit with you.
Thanks for having me.
We spend a lot of time talking about the restaurant scene. It's important to the business of Chicago. It's also important to folks that like to eat at restaurants. Ryan O'Donnell is the founder and CEO of Ballyhoo Hospitality. It's a group of restaurants throughout the area. Hey, Ryan, you're on the air. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about your restaurants. I know you're in Lincoln Park, you're in the city, you're also in the north suburbs. Tell me about your restaurants.
Yeah, we started with Gemini back in 2009. It was called Gemini Bistro. Did a revamp in 2017. Dropped the bistro, just call it Gemini now. We have Côte de Volpe, Italian, Southern Italian, and South Fork Corridor. Billy Lawless is a partner with us there. We just opened Danucci's, another Italian spot right across from Gemini in the Old Port Farthing space. We have a Mexican cantina called Old Pueblo over on Webster and Racine in the Old John's place. And then, we have some stuff up in the North Shore, Sophia Steaks in Wilmette and Lake Forest. And then we also have Pomeroy, which is a French brasserie in Winnetka.
Wow.
I just left my sandwich shop and bakery, Buck Russell and Wilmette. And then right next to that's a pizza place called Pizza Out. So I think we're up to nine places now and working on a few others.
We're starting to lose you on that cell. I know you're driving, but I think this is going to work. It sounds like the line is clear now. So a variety of restaurants throughout the area, and you've been expanding. It's interesting to me, you've got a footprint then in Chicago and in the suburbs. And in the suburbs, they won't have to increase the sub-minimum wage. And in the city, you will. Is that kind of on your radar these days?
How I understand it, we got a 5-year runway to deal with that in the city. I think Cook County, I don't know if they're going to be far behind or what's going to happen up there, but as of now, it's holding firm. So
it's holding firm. Well, next year you'll have to increase the wage of the servers 20% in Lincoln Park.
In the city stores, for sure. Yep, we will. And there's good and bad to that. Equal wages is important, I think, but obviously there's going to be some navigating costs and how we try to stay profitable. Labor is a huge component of the business, so it's going to be something we'll have to figure out.
The question we've been asking everybody is what's going to happen to menu prices, and they wouldn't have to go up 20% because it's not 100% of the cost is labor, but it's, I presume, a high percent. Do you anticipate having to change some of the prices?
I think that's the initial kind of easy answer is, just raise menu prices. But that can backfire too, and the perception of being overpriced is another thing we got to take into account. So So I don't know if that's just going to solve the problem. I mean, different styles of service. Looking at how we run food, how we bus tables, how we run drinks, and kind of looking at steps of service and sequence of service. I think there's another way we can try to minimize the effect of the raises. So I think there's a couple ways you can go about it. I don't know that menu price raising is the exact answer.
Yeah. Is it harder to run a restaurant in Chicago than the suburbs? And I'm not talking about the wage issue so much as maybe staffing and attracting customers into the city. How do you see the challenges of that?
I think that used to be the fear of the suburbs, is how do you get staff up there? There's not enough people. It's not as the density isn't as great as the city. We found that it's pretty much the same. A lot of people live in the suburbs. The suburban Great Migration of 2020 and the COVID thing was helpful in the fact that more people moved up to the suburbs, and also staff and employees as well. So I think it's kind of we found it's very similar to running restaurant city.
Is it hard, though? I mean, it seems to me like it still depends on where you go. Some places are understaffed still, maybe some aren't. How difficult is it to get people to work in the restaurant business?
It's very difficult. It's always one of the biggest challenges, and, you know, I think it always has been. So it's nothing new that we're experiencing. I think it's more difficult than it has been in the past, but it's something that's always been at the forefront of our company and Value Hospitality, and the word culture is always talked about, and that's very important. So giving people a place that they want to come to work every day and feeling good about how they're treated, of course, you know, making money and having successful restaurants that, you know, that do well, I think is some, you know, it's a catalyst for being able to staff properly as well. So we're very fortunate in the fact that our restaurants are doing pretty good right now.
Here's a text from a listener, 312, says, love their restaurants. This is Julie. I used to work at WGN, and I love going to the restaurants that you're talking about. So there's one for you. I do say this, that there are restaurants you walk in, and you can tell the staff is in a happier mood, that they must like working there more than other places. When you talk about the culture of a restaurant group, that must be what you're talking about, because one way or another, I think as customers, we feel it, you know?
Yeah, well, it starts with the staff. They're on the front line, and, you know, making sure that we treat them as good, if not better, than we treat the guests that come into our restaurant is kind of the goal. It should be a trickle-down effect, and if the staff feels great about the way that they're treated, they should be treating the guests the same way. So that's a real core philosophy for us. Obviously, you know, the benefits and the perks are also important. It's a big deal for us.
Ryan O'Donnell's on the line, the founder and CEO of Ballyhoo Hospitality. So it's Gemini, it's Sophia in Wilmette and Lake Forest, it's Old Pueblo and Lincoln Park. What is there a cuisine that is hot in Chicago right now? Is it Korean? Is it Italian? I mean, is there something that is smart to get into in terms of what's on the menu?
I don't know. I think what's smart is to get behind something that you have a chef who is very good at. You know, we're partners with Doug Saltis over in Andros Taverna, and, you know, Greek food isn't something I would have ever tried without someone like Doug, who specializes he specializes in multi-cuisines, but, you know, Greek's a passion for him. So I think getting behind, you know, making sure you have a chef that knows how to execute concept and the cuisine that you're going for is really important. There's trends come and go. Everything circles back. You know, Israeli cuisine was really hot, Mediterranean. You know, I don't know that I would, you know, pin one specific cuisine right now.
I would guess, though, that steaks, Italian food, and sandwiches in Chicago and the suburbs are a pretty good bet. Ryan O'Donnell, the founder and CEO of Ballyhoo Hospitality. Okay, Ryan, thanks for your time. More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new report says hotel rates in major global cities are about to increase by double digits, and Chicago is one of the cities where room rates are expected to climb. Figures come from the Hotel Monitor 2024 report by American Express Global Business Travel. Chicago is sixth on the list with a projected 12.6% increase in hotel rates. Buenos Aires tops the list with a projected 17% increase in room rates. Boston is the only other U.S. city in the top 10 with a projected increase of 11%. The expected rise locally is attributed to an uptick in business travel to Chicago. A popular donut shop has plans to open in Chicago. Voodoo Donut started in Portland 20 years ago and has developed a loyal national following. Cranes reports the Chicago location is planned for 945 West Randolph in Fulton Market. It'll be the chain's 21st U.S. store and the first in the Midwest. It could open as early as next year. Voodoo Donut has a lineup that includes 50 different creations. One of the more popular is the Bacon Maple Bar, a donut bar with maple frosting and bacon. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
I love me a maple frosted donut. Where was I? Business of Food, Steve Alexander.
Yes, thank you. We're still 4 days away from the Chicago Marathon, but we will hear from one of the winners. After I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us, it's truck season. Put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, even before the Bank of America Marathon is run, I have on the phone one of the winners.
My name is Daniel Briceno, and then I'm the chef and founder at Fonz Empanadas.
Yes, restaurants along the marathon route will see a huge bump in business before, during, and after the marathon. What was the name of your restaurants again, Daniel?
It's Fonz Empanadas.
Thank you. And you have three restaurants along or near the marathon route?
Yes, we do have one that is on Clark Street and on Rivet. That's in Lincoln Park. There is another one on Randolph and Wabash by the Millennium Park. And there is another one on Lake and Jefferson in the West Loop.
And here is what Marathon Week means for his business.
About 150% of a normal Saturday or Sunday, people pre-race and then after the race having some of the empanadas and smoothies that we offer there.
I suppose you have a lot of people coming in after the race wearing their medals and their foil blankets.
Oh, yeah.
How about runners? You have any of the recreational runners stopping off during the race?
That would be awesome, right?
I think that's a no. The marathon estimates 1.7 million spectators will be lining the streets in 29 neighborhoods. Restaurants all along the route will cash in. And at Fonz, there's a special for Marathon Week.
Yes, I'll buy three and get one free empanada.
And Daniel says Fonz Empanadas not only benefits from the race, it benefits from the race's sponsor.
Yes, Bank of America is the bank that we use to process payments, but at the same time, they offer us small business consulting in terms of the financial things that we can do.
Including expansion, more cities in the Midwest coming soon.
Yes, Milwaukee, Ohio, Indianapolis.
And coinciding with the added traffic from the marathon, it's National Hispanic Heritage Month and, beginning Friday, Latin Restaurant Weeks. If your name is Betty, today's your day. It's National Apple Betty Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Dale Buss is a longtime automotive journalist. He talks to us about a number of issues affecting us in the Midwest through an organization called the Flyover Coalition. Dale, we've tapped you today to just run through for us quickly how the UAW is negotiating with the automakers. Give me some headlines.
Sure. Well, things keep happening incrementally in a way, which is how this thing has kind of gone, which is a good sign for the economy at this point. I mean, it hasn't really affected supplies of vehicles to any huge extent at this point. It has caused hundreds, couple hundreds, not many thousands of layoffs at the automakers and some suppliers, and the auto companies and the UAW keep moving closer together in their negotiations. I mean, for instance, today General Motors said that it just made its sixth offer to the UAW since the talks began, moving closer on the crucial issues such as wage increases, shortening the amount of time it takes for somebody to get from part-time to full-time wages, and all the stuff that the UAW says it's concerned about. So at this point, you know, Sean Fain, the president of the UAW, has used very, very strong rhetoric, the strongest that we've seen in at least a generation, from the UAW leader to describe the automakers and their executives as, you know, capitalist barons and even much worse. But he has not made this strike yet something that's going to can the economy. He's been kind of judicious about that. So I think at this point, there's still hope for a resolution to this in the coming, you know, week or two, perhaps. But we'll see.
It's different offers or different negotiations with the different companies. And I want to just click through those real quick. But I also want to take note of this. This is from the Washington Post. They said full-time UAW workers at the big three, full-time UAW workers at the big three earn about $18 to $32 an hour, depending on seniority, wages that have lagged behind inflation. They also get annual profit-sharing bonuses that have totaled tens of thousands of dollars per worker over the last 4 years. Temporary workers get $16 to $19 an hour and don't get profit-sharing payments or other bonuses. I thought they made more than that. Maybe the bonuses at the end of the year make up for the hourly wage, but I thought those guys were more like $40 an hour or something like that.
Well, if you add the bonuses in, I mean, they can be, you know, $8,000, $10,000, $12,000, $14,000 a year. And so while the union complains that, you know, the companies have been making lots of profits through the last several years, and the CEOs and top executives get, you know, hundreds of times the median pay of an auto worker. The fact is that, you know, they have benefited, hourly workers have benefited from the profits of the automakers to, you know, pretty significant degree. I mean, anybody in the middle class getting an $8,000, $10,000, $12,000, $14,000 bonus check at the end of the year is pretty significant. But, you know, their basic complaint is the auto companies have done better and the executives have done better since the bankruptcy trough of 2008-2009 than blue-collar workers and union members have done. And in that, they're essentially correct, which is why the auto companies all individually to different degrees have agreed to wage gains of 20 to 25% over the next 4 years, which is the most significant that they've ever granted.
So what's the Ford offer then?
The four, I don't have the specifics in front of me, but each of the big three is, you know, the Detroit three is generally kind of in the same ballpark. Ford the other day said that they would come up with more than 20% raises over the four-year period. But, you know, essentially they're all going to end up in that ballpark of maybe 20 to 25% total over the 4 years of a new agreement.
Is the elephant in the room the electric cars that are coming, which will require fewer workers?
Yeah, it is in a big sense, which means, you know, in the largest possible picture, you could argue the union is just trying to make things, you know, rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic and trying to make them as comfortable as possible for its members. They're not going to have job growth. Electric cars require many fewer workers, and the Detroit 3 have promised, you know, we're not going to lay anybody off because of electric cars, but that's not the same thing as saying we're going to preserve jobs. There's a lot of attrition among older workers, and that is the elephant in the room. And that's why when Donald Trump followed Joe Biden last week and came to Detroit and met with actually non-union workers at a supplier, he was trashing EVs because he said, you know, Biden may be trying to help you guys on one hand by supporting you and coming and walking your picket line, but on the other hand, he and his administration are the ones pushing EVs on the American people. Consumers don't want them yet, but the government is forcing automakers to, you know, dig and build huge new EV plants. And this is not good for you guys and gals in the union in the long term. And there's a lot of truth to that.
But that's also a perilous message because there's plenty of people making a lot of money at those plants making electric cars right now. I mean, if I were a Detroit worker, I would see the writing on the wall that electric cars are coming, and Donald Trump can say whatever he wants about the future, but electric cars are going to be a main part of the future.
Right. It's just they're not going to require nearly as many UAW workers to make them. I mean, if you're working at an engine or a transmission plant right now, that's GM or Ford or Stellantis operate many in the upper Midwest, you know, you're not in a good position. I mean, you may have to transfer to a new EV plant that's, you know, in Kentucky or whatever. So, you know, they're not sitting pretty by any means in the UAW. And so, you know, this is in some ways a last gasp attempt to make the surviving or remaining union workers as well compensated as possible.
Dale Buss, longtime automotive journalist, founder and executive director of the Flyover Coalition. Okay, Dale, we'll check on this again. Thanks for your help today.
All right. Thanks, John.